Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Hey, good morning. And Truman, thank you for that great rendition of Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant. We got an order to go, and it's fabulous.
Isn't that great? Hey, we have to do that every Thanksgiving. That's our Thanksgiving song. So
that was great. Thanks, Truman. And that welcome was from our founder, Brian Brown. You're listening to the Thanksgoing 2020 version this November 24th of the Brown Briefly, where finally we're living in some hope that we will have a peaceful new year after January 20th. Breaking news talked about our certification of some of the remaining electoral counts and the concession, not from Trump, but from the person that was in her general accounting office to give approval for the beginning of the transition. So we are celebrating a little bit today. We're going to indulge ourselves a little more in some righteous indignation over the most recent of Trump's depredations as he continues to seek to maintain office indefinitely. And I think that must be to avoid having to face his rabid base. That must be worse than hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes and loans coming due, and worse even than the criminal prosecutions he faces in New York when he's no longer president. I keep thinking, couldn't Trump go on to found a company of mercenaries with that posse of his? Their symbol could be black socks with the red heel, and they could be called bone spurs, and they could travel in their RVs to remote areas to solve, quote, previously unsolvable business problems. Trump could even go off the grid. Wouldn't our carbon footprint shrink? So today we'll have some additional Thanksgiving discussion, kind of headed towards some kind of positivity, discussing about whether America is indeed ungovernable, and followed by what on earth could possibly bring us together. But first, some introductions and any announcements anybody has. I'm your host today, Lynn Kerrigan, and with us live in our happening studio in bustling downtown Vachon is sound engineer and techno wizard Truman O'Brien, the liege lord of Zoomdom. How goes it today, Truman?
That's great, and I'm telling you, these titles keep getting better all the time. I'm not sure. Between the Guardian of the Galaxy, Bruce and me, man, we're going to run things, I think, you know, by the time we're done. It's going great. The studio is cold this morning, though, darn it. And I keep trying to turn the heat up, and I can't get it done. So I'm sitting here shivering.
And you got no sweater with you.
No, I'm going to get my jacket here in a minute, though.
There you go. Please do. How's everybody else? Gail?
Oh, I am just beaming this morning. I just finished watching our president-elect and vice president-elect introduce the cabinet nominees. And I am having such a moment I haven't had in many years now, four plus, of just pride, you know, in our government and in the possibility for a sane future. I'm
yes.
Really happy.
Yes. Gail is our futurist writer and dream catcher on the A-plus team that the Brown Brieflies are. I'm on a roll with names and designations today. And bruised and battered, the ever-watchful guardian of our galaxy and default coach, Bruce Hallman. How are you, Bruce? Muted.
He's muted. That's how he is.
Muted today.
Yeah, I'm doing great. Just looking forward to a quiet Thanksgiving. You know, nobody's traveling, nobody's gathering, sort of in keeping with the guidelines. And it'll be fascinating to see if Anthony Fauci's right, that we're going to see a super sort of bloom on top of the already blooming sort of rate of COVID increases that's happening right now. And I suspect we will. But on the other hand, you know, very encouraged about the potentials for these vaccines, particularly the ones that are one shot, you know, low temperature sort of distribution. I think they will make a difference. And even Fauci was saying by May, April or May, we could have 70% of the American people inoculated. And that would turn the corner. It'll be a long time before we're back to whatever we think of as normal. But, you know, we're on the way potentially.
I have to just jump in and say one thing before the rest of the introductions. And that is, I just read an article about the process of developing these vaccines. And it is absolutely fascinating. One of the things that was most interesting about it is that the technique that they've developed with this RNA development is that they think that they're going to be able to treat a whole lot of other ailments. And if we do have another pandemic, that they'll be all over it really soon because they have this new technology. It's pretty fascinating. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
All the new DNA technology is really amazing. Thank you, Truman. How about let's hear from our Democratic pitchman and heavy hitter, Indivisible Vashon's intrepid, Kevin Jones.
Hey, I echo Gail's sentiment. If you have not had the opportunity to watch President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris introduce some of the members of their team, it's a treat. Bindon, his father-in-law, who escaped one of hundreds of children from one particular school, the only survivor of the Holocaust, and as he was escaping through the woods, heard the rumble of a tank and saw five stars painted on the side of the tank, and said the only three words he knew as the tank approached him, "God bless America," and was basically saved from some such extensive disaster in World War II. The people that we were introduced to today are truly inspirational in terms of the change that we can anticipate with this administration.
Great news, isn't it? You know, it makes me think a little bit about at the end of World War II when Hitler had given the call to sack Paris, and it was over, the war was over. But one officer decided he wasn't going to do that and slow walked literally the order from wherever he was stationed into Paris. And by then the troops had come home. And what I think sometimes is the courage of people in government to know the right thing to do, even when other people don't. And that leads me to Michael Shook, our plain-spoken outfielder who likes to get to the root of things. How are you doing, Mike? What's up?
I'm doing swell, Lynn. Thank you. I've had a lot of epithets sent my way, but I'm not sure if plain-spoken has ever been one. Too damn talkative is one that I hear quite a bit. But
no, Michael, I say that because you tend to come around to the deep feeling that is lodged in much of the conflict that we have been reporting on,
well,
and the deep emotions that people just feel.
That's very kind. It's this is a momentous time. It's in keeping with Truman's comment about science. It's a nice little coincidence that on this day in 1859, Charles Darwin released The Origin of Species.
And I remember that well.
Well, of course you.
You time traveler.
Time traveling. I've been reading some books on evolutionary psychology and going back and reading chunks of Origin of the Species and everything. And it's hard to calculate how extraordinary an event that was, how it changed everything. And in a way, you know, that those were some of the early steps toward where we are now, understanding RNA, DNA, genetic selection, and now we can actually get in there and tinker with things. So part of me is very cautiously optimistic about that, because science can go any number of ways. But it's a wonderful breakthrough. So I'm really grateful for that. Truman, what'd you...
You know, when you were talking about introducing the cabinet and or the cabinet nominations, one of the things that I find both heartening and interesting is that, you know, Trump, one of the things about Trump was that he never listened to anybody. It didn't matter who it was. He didn't listen. He made up his own mind about whatever he thought it was and went with it. And I think that has caused most of the problems that we're in now. And the thing that is heartening to me is that I think that at least Biden is going to listen to somebody when they tell him something. It's going to make a difference, you know. And gosh, to put people in there who know what the heck they're doing rather than just being cronies of, you know, Trump, I think we got a chance to do something pretty interesting here. Kevin. You're muted, Kevin. You're muted. Kevin, you're muted.
Find the mouse. Find
there
the
we
mouse.
Go.
Thank you. And if you haven't seen the breaking news, Pennsylvania has now certified. So what that means basically is that of all of the states that are expected to certify without drama, meaning all of those states that voted blue in 2016, he now has 279. And that maybe even if Nevada somehow gets tripped up, he still has over 270 certified Electoral College votes if those states come through, which they're expected. So the certification drama is probably pretty much in the rearview mirror. And that's really good news for everybody who wants to see President Biden.
I think that's fabulous. And you actually lead us right into our first kind of topic of discussion this week, which is kind of the idea of this week that we've been kind of in limbo, waiting to hear about the electoral certifications and the recounts that are still happening. Georgia's on its third recount right now. The first one was an audit, and now it's some other kind of recount, and still waiting to see, demands that votes be thrown out in Wayne County, Detroit, Michigan area. You know, he seems to be going after some highly African-American populated cities, you know, in really bizarre attacks to me. I just have not understood that. And I was so surprised when Trump decided to fire the national election supervisor, Christopher Krebs, because he said that this was the most secure election in history, which just blew my mind out of the water. And I couldn't understand how it could even be legal. I'd really like to hear people talk about, you know, how is it possible that somebody can just rampage around government, you know, firing people willy-nilly and starting all these unsupported lawsuits, well, you know, just to drag things out.
Well, Bruce. I mean, that's the nature of our democracy. I mean, everybody has their day in court and everybody's innocent until proven guilty. I mean, you know, that's the rule of law, and Trump has tried to trample on it at times, but it's held up largely. And it's the nature of, I mean, Trump rails against the deep state, but the reason you have a deep state is that basically those appointed officers who come in are just there at the whim of the president. And that's why he can hire them and fire them or make temporary appointments so they don't have to be appointed with the consent of the Senate. It's an interesting structure, but it's not, those aren't the people who run the government. People who run the government are the next level down, and they're career civil servants, and that's why you have it. And that's why the schools stay open. That's why water flows and electricity comes through and that kind of stuff, because we have that second level. And it's not at the whim of the president to make that work or not work. I mean, he can certainly muck it up, and we've seen that. But, you know, it's certainly that's why the deep state is what saves us when we have idiots in charge.
Hey, Gail, go ahead. Thank you, Bruce.
Well, I just wanted to thank Bruce for talking about the deep state back, this might have been over a year ago, but for our listener, to remind you that it's the deep state is that part of government that functions and keeps, as Bruce, you're saying, the library doors open and the school rooms available and roads, you know, are continue to be repaired and things like this. And the term deep state, suddenly I've heard it used a few times in the last few years as if it's some nefarious, terrible, you know, hidden operation of, you know, instead of, you know, because it sounds a little, it would sound good in a movie, but in fact, what it refers to is deep stability of a country. And I'm so grateful, not only that we have that kind of deep stability that does seem to have in large part survived the Trump moment. I won't say era, I'm not giving him that much, but that we're going on to more of that. When I see the kind of commitment and a quality of person that Biden has chosen in the cabinet.
Anybody else want to weigh in on any of this? I heard this morning, I will just say, I always wake up to NPR, and I did hear Bob Ferguson, Washington State's Attorney General, talking about they had been preparing with several other people plans to sue Trump over the administration's refusal to step aside and start a transition process. And he himself was very relieved, he said, that he didn't feel like they had to go through with it right now, that they were getting worried that it would be a national security issue to leave Biden so unprepared and leave the country so unprepared for anything that might come up during this time. So it is the way government works, I think, but boy, was it extreme in this case. It felt extreme. I thought you might come back with Herbert Hoover, Bruce, which I heard had also a difficult transition process.
Right. Yeah. Well, the person to look to is Grover Cleveland. Grover Cleveland was president, was defeated, and then came back 4 years later and ran again and won. So we had a two-term Cleveland presidency with an interim in between. So don't rest too assured. I mean, it's fascinating to me that, I mean, Hillary got 3 million more votes than Trump did and didn't win the Electoral College. I mean, Biden's gotten 6 million more popular votes than Trump. But that still means 74 million people voted for Trump. So, it's good to be euphoric that we've got a new administration coming in and some very competent people taking over agencies. But the moment or age or era, whatever you want to call it, Gail, moment I like, it gives it that sort of fleeting sort of element to it. But, you know, Trumpism and what Trump represents is not going to be gone, even without Trump. You know, so we need to be vigilant. You know, as Jefferson said, you know, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance.
There you go. Michael and then Gail.
Those are really important points, Bruce. I read where Trump is pulling levers as fast as he can and as much as possible to try to make sure that he keeps some of his people in key positions with the Republican National Committee. And there's an enormous number of folks who want to see a second Trump presidency, or at least, from what I've been reading, a continuation of a lot of those different kinds of things that Trump was doing. And I guess I kind of say what Trump was doing, but I honestly wonder sometimes if it wasn't more Mitch McConnell and like you were saying, maybe not the deep state, but a number of representatives who would love to see things continue along the path that Trump started them on. So and those folks aren't going away. That this is where the Democrats have really got to pay attention, and it's something that I've talked about a number of times before: is can they deliver the goods? People need jobs. They need hope. You've got huge areas of the country where folks are, millions have just given up on getting a job that they can support themselves on. And that kind of anger and frustration, well, this time it turned towards the Democrats because I think probably Trump failed so badly. What's going to happen if the Democrats can't deliver on some things?
Yeah, really good points. Gail, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I was just going to add, I think those are all really valid and interesting points. Chet, I see your name there, and Bruce, thank you for that. And I was wanted to say that though over 70 plus million people did vote for Trump, I think that there is going to be a vast change in the atmosphere that supported that. I think we've learned a lot. I think that coming to share, having, being able to share, have a shared reality in America is very important to this. I mean, some of the reason those 70 plus million people voted that way was because of a lot of disinformation, lies, false promises, you know, pointing fingers in directions that have nothing to do with the fact that they may be struggling. And so I hope that 4 years of some sanity, and I do appreciate particularly the idea that we do need to keep track of the middle and lower class that are suffering. Yeah. But I do think that once we have a shared reality, we can have a shared morality. That I think is actually underneath it. I think we actually do have quite a shared morality in most cases. So bring around that shared reality and we can begin to govern ourselves again.
Michael and Kevin.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject here. I think that's really true, Gail. But something that occurred to me the other day was I was thinking, you know, this many people voted for Trump. And I realized that's not really accurate. There's probably, 74 million people in the country. That is an enormous number of people. And I think probably the majority of them did not so much vote for Trump as they voted for a lot of the things that the Republican committee and the Republican senators and Congress folks represent for them. And a good example is the fellow who was interviewed a couple of weeks ago in the Seattle Times, who said he was going to vote for Trump again. And he came right out in the paper and said he's an apple orchardist in Eastern Washington, over near Ellensburg, I think. And he said, I hate the guy. I mean, he just came right out and said, I can't stand Trump. I don't like the way he talks. I don't like many of the things that he does. But he says, by golly, the initiatives and the things that are being done on his watch are helping my business flourish. And, you know, when you talk to people, it gets really quickly down to that. Am I able to earn a living or not? And if I am, okay, I'm good to go with it. And if I'm not, something's got to change.
Yeah, I heard that, Michael. He was talking about some of the tariff and trade policies that Trump has put into play. Isn't that right? Do you remember?
I think there were some of those things, yeah, which have hurt
a lot of other people, yeah,
terribly in the Midwest.
Yeah.
But it's so local, you know, that for this apple grower, things were going well for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Kev.
You know, it's intriguing in that been schooled on misinformation, disinformation more and more throughout this last 4 years. And so much of what we hear is either a fiction that we can verify as a fiction. I mean, there's certainly a lot of lies that have come from this administration. But I think that we have a real strength, and if frankly, Voice of Vashon represents one element of that strength, is independent media who can really help address some of the misinformation and disinformation. And we talked a little bit last time about the economy with an increase of unemployment by 2.2% under the Trump administration. We know that the Obama-Biden administration brought us back from the worst recession since the Great Depression. And with long and sustained job and career growth. So we know that this administration can do that. And clearly misinformation suggests that they can't. On climate, clearly that was a big emphasis of the rollout, and now a new position on the Biden's team of a climate focus with John Kerry. But the idea that while we hear statements about wanting clean air and water, and we have the cleanest air and the cleanest water, in reality, this administration was working hard to roll back the emission standards of automobiles and pushing hard for let's keep those gas, internal combustion engines going. The reality is that, with all the nations surrounding who have signed up for the Paris Climate Accord, none of those countries are going to want to buy gas-powered cars in the next 15 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. Our auto industry at risks on the trajectory that we were on, encouraging us to stay with, high emission cars and gas powered cars, is basically due for a reckoning if those industries don't shift. So I think that's where some of the misinformation really needs to be set aside. And we can look at policy through multiple lenses. We need the conservative lens. We need the liberal lens. But I think we need to have honesty and fair characterization, and then maybe get behind the things that we want.
I really appreciate both of those viewpoints, Gail and Kevin, and it really helps me transition a little bit to the second question I wanted for us to discuss. There was an article, now it feels like forever ago, September 27th, in the New York Times Sunday Review, that asked two writers to explore the question about, is America ungovernable? So it was a much more anxious and perhaps fearful time then when this was written. But these articles got exactly to what both of you, all of you, are pointing out, which is that there are some serious policy questions that we have yet to satisfy everyone with. Maybe we'll never do that. But there are some things that have been laid to rest for so long, they keep jumping up and refusing to go away. Frank Bruni was one of the authors who said that he thought Trump has driven America and democracy completely into the ground, and that he has inflamed differences and divisions and degraded our institutions. And he's polarized us such that party politics are making all Americans feel unsafe and unwelcome by the other side. And he just thinks we are at the cusp of danger with tribalism and authoritarianism kind of run rampant. The other article suggests that America is really in need of a good fight, but that we really have to address what seems to be a rural and urban divide and racial divides in this country. And there are other taboo subjects like abortion that have just been sort of set aside and not slugged. We have not slugged these things out to a point where we could get past some of them to being more shared, more unified in our realities. They're recommending we continue with some strong debates and real attempts to support populations at risk. And this is going to mean some real obvious and serious change. What do you think about that? What do you think could be useful as we try to think about policies that are maybe centrist or maybe swing back and forth so that it's not winner take all the time, which is what it feels like we've devolved to a little bit. So I'm asking, what do you think about this dilemma that they have posed?
Well, let me jump in.
Please.
America is certainly governable, and America's had divisions all along. It's nothing new. It's at an intensity level that we haven't seen probably for 140, 50 years since slavery sort of ripped the country apart. But I mean, all through the late 19th century, sort of progressive versus capital, struggles went on, during the Great Depression, after World War II, the Cold War sort of ripped us apart. On one level, it's nothing new, but what gives me faith is that when you look at the really far right, sort of the heavy core far right and the heavy core far left, I mean, they're both about 25% of the population, if you will. You know, any far right candidate, no matter how outrageous they are, can get 25 or 30% of the vote. Same thing with anybody on the far left. It's that sort of 50% in the middle. And that's what I think Biden won this election. Biden was able to appeal to that great middle. And the secret of American politics is you've got to run from the center. I mean, no matter where your proclivities are, and, you know, as much damage as the Clinton sort of approach made to certain parts of the American culture and led to a Trump kind of response, you know, it was a brilliant kind of strategy to govern from the middle. And I think that's what we have to do with a strong progressive sort of drive behind that and realize that the center, you know, sort of the rising tides raises all boats kind of thing. You know, as the economy improves, you know, as businesses and small businesses do better, you know, everybody working will do better. And so it's that I think we abandon the middle at the risk of having another Trump in power.
Yeah. Kev.
You know, I can see why the framing of that question, is America ungovernable? You know, I can understand why that question is being asked, while completely agreeing with Bruce that it's almost a false premise. You know, we clearly, the notion of kidnapping and killing state governors like Whitmer in Michigan and perhaps, you know, trapping legislators in the state house and not letting them emerge alive, clearly people who have that agenda need to be addressed, and as was done, and I hope will continue to be addressed. But the idea that, in my mind, government is how we manage a population, I mean, come down to sort of basic relationships, and managing a population is done through lots of different mechanisms, right? We have education, we have culture, we have religion, we have the government. But the idea that, you know, the government can choose to incite tensions, or they can, you know, raise tension, or they can promote unity. Governments have an opportunity to promote violence or demote violence. We've seen what I would say is, in my lifetime, a pretty unprecedented promotion of violence and promotion of division. And, and that makes, I think, the population much less governable than otherwise. And so I'm hoping that that pendulum can move back, and I think we'll see a more governable population in so doing.
Thank you. I agree. Gail.
Yes, I'm very hopeful that that pendulum is going to swing back as we see reasonable. People look so sane up there right now when you hear Biden and the cabinet just speaking this morning. I think the other thing that's changed in the last 4 years is, in particular, is how we get our news and how some of these big corporations that are involved with social media mitigate the truth. And so one of the things that I am really pleased at, concerned on one level, but pleased, is both Google, Facebook, Twitter have all come up with systems by which to manage mistruths being perpetrated and allowed to just run wild. That gives me a lot of hope, as does the fact that I think Americans in general, at least I think that journalists in particular have somehow begun to negotiate the new internet as opposed to for as a news source, as opposed to the daily papers. So I'm encouraged when I hear that the New York Times still employs 1,500 journalists, and you know they're committed to fact-based reporting, and more than ever, I think people are flocking to organizations like that where they feel they're going to be told the truth.
Yeah, and that reminds me that there's also other watchdogs that have been set up over social media to help with that, you know, fact-checking organizations and ProPublica, and some of those are really taking on an internal industry.
You're starting to
recognition of the fact that they have to hold themselves accountable.
You're starting to cut out a little bit, Lynn. I don't know what's going on with your signal. But one thing I wanted to
take over if I cut out.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to mention, you know, we've talked about this a lot, about the change in news and the change in, I mean, how everything is instant, you know, and Bruce in particular has talked about how this has happened in the past and we've learned how to regulate it. And I think this is starting to happen now, like you said, Gail, that there's some, I think we really have to be careful about how we do that, you know, without limiting the free speech and all of that. I'm with you. I think we've got a chance now to slowly get a handle on that. Mike?
Yeah, that's a really good, just this great discussion. I love this. And that turning that we're starting to see, that change of the different organizations that you cited, Lynn, but also the government is also, you know, the people are saying, okay, it's time to maybe pull back on the reins and slow this team down. The other thing that you brought up, Lynn, I think having a good, strong debate about it, I think that could be enormously helpful. And I don't know how that would work, but the idea of it is very appealing to me. To maybe have, I don't know, not like a Chautauqua or something, but a you know, some sort of a national
and a forum or something,
real debate, not like when William F. Buckley Jr. debated James Baldwin. And I forget the university that was at, Columbia, I think. I'm not sure. But that was a fabulous debate, and it was a real debate. You know, it wasn't fielding some question and then something like that. It was back and forth, you know, here's my points. I think we could benefit greatly from that.
Gail and then Bruce.
I think Kevin was on board before me. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, it's intriguing that with given social media, and of course, we talked about the new being a new way to communicate and that doesn't have the regulatory structure that others have. But now what we're seeing, right, is Trump's tweets are now starting to get labeled by Twitter as, you know, unfactual. I actually posted some information on Facebook about the election results about a month ago, maybe, well, 3 weeks. No, it was sort of leading up to the election and what the polling numbers were saying. And Facebook labeled that and said, here's where you find polling data, right? You pointed to an online source like NBC News or whatever. So, I mean, I do see that social media is starting to get into a more regulatory framework. I just would love to see like a plot. I'm a data guy, right? I'd love to see a plot of the increasing number of Trump tweets that are now being labeled by Twitter about that. Maybe we'll see that one day.
Enough to annoy him, that's for sure. Gail and Bruce.
I was going to respond to Michael's comment and your thought that we need to have a real, you know, slog it out, have a really vigorous debate on topics. And although I think that has its place, I also wonder if we don't need also something more on the gentler side of conversations around kitchen tables, amongst neighbors in, you know, town to town, where people who have different viewpoints listen to one another and learn, you know, using some, there are many ways to have, there are ways to have conversations with people who don't agree with us. And I think that searching those out, I've imagined something, I've termed it the purple tablecloth project, where you just lay down a purple tablecloth and you sit down and it's an invitation to have a conversation, whether it's in a park, given that we have a pandemic, or, you know, I don't know, just some way for people to make actual connections, because it's very easy to demonize people we don't know. And it can change on a micro level, all I believe also then can accrue into change on a macro level.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. And then let's twist towards what could we do to support coming together. Mm-hmm. Bruce, go ahead.
Well, in part, it's conversations are good, but it takes leadership.
Yes.
You know, I reflect back on the LBJ era and when Lady Bird Johnson undertook a Beautify America campaign. Just to clean up the roads and just to pick up trash and it made a huge impact and it made a huge difference in sort of just what America looks like, because it started the conversation, but it took leadership. It took an initiative. And that's what I think the Biden administration needs to do, is begin those kinds of initiatives about, you know, civil discourse, about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable when you have differences, and getting away from sort of the Trump demonization of somebody with a handicap or somebody is, you know, slow this or sleepy that or whatever. I mean, that is destructive. And having that kind of conversation, but it takes leadership to have the conversation.
I so appreciate that. These are good thoughts to end on. We've got about 4 minutes, and I thought it would be good to go out this time really thinking about, you know, what is the strategy about wanting to heal a nation? Bruce, I think you're talking about, to me, some of the most important, critical, and immediate things that can change with his style of leadership. You know, he's more of a very careful, fact-based diplomat. You know, he's less fabricated as a persona. He's less bombastic and kind of, you know, terrifyingly riveting to watch. You know, like you can't take your eye off a car wreck. and yet, you know, we do need to unify and come together, but we can't dismiss, you know, the strains and the frays and the concerns that the marginalized and vulnerable people are that we have. And I'm just kind of, you know, I don't want this to be a Pollyannish kind of thing, but I'm really thinking, how do we walk this line? What kind of events or values or goals or other things could we start talking about as a way to heal?
Well, if I can jump in, I mean, in part, what Franklin D. Roosevelt did in his inauguration speech was say, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. And he instituted a whole measure, and a lot of them worked and a lot of them didn't work, but immediate changes that addressed what was happening in the 1930s with the Great Depression. And Michael's right. I mean, there need to be jobs programs, there needs
yes.
to be programs for schools, and hey, I mean, the federal money is there, and the federal money in the defense budget and other budgets is there. It's a matter of how we prioritize it and how we spend it. And so my sense is we need very much a New Deal, a New Deal type approach that opens up all of those issues that have driven people to Trump and draw them back away from that. That's
critical. Yes. I like it. Truman.
Well, we only have about a minute and a half left, but I think the answer, folks, is in the Utah desert. Have you seen what they've discovered in the Utah desert?
Monolith.
The monolith. I mean, there it is. That's the unifying.
What?
There's the unifying thing right there.
What are you saying?
You haven't seen this? Come on.
No,
this is breaking news. I mean, come on.
It's 2001, A Space Odyssey.
That's right. That's right. The helicopter crew, they were out, Department of Public Safety or whatever, their wildlife resource folks. So they found this 10 to 12 foot steel monolith out in the middle of the desert, buried deep. I mean, it's sticking up out of the ground, and they don't know where it came from. So I think it's aliens. They've come to make us talk, and this is going to be our talking point right here.
What I like is humor. Humor needs to come back. And mystery and kind of curiosity.
Well, there
so
it
thank
is.
You for
See,
that.
There it is. And if we get out there, we're going to meet around this obelisk, you know.
And what Gail said was really important. Conversations and really practicing listening. I can always improve that greatly. And that's going to help so much. because then it helps us build a relationship. And that's, you're right, Gail, that's what can change. Kevin, what'd you...
Okay, otherwise, I think maybe the Sheet Metal Workers of America have something to do with
it. There you go. There you go. Okay, guys. Hey, we're out of time.
I think we're seeing the fog light.
We are.